Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, July 1st. I'm Ray Graff. Well, depending on where you are in the region, you probably have seen quite a bit of rain over the last several days. Let me tell you, the plants are loving that, and we'll talk about that today because it's another edition of The Gardening Show, and we welcome back Bob Graves of Fadigan's Nursery and Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum. They're on the line to answer your questions. Make sure you're looking good in the old yard this summer. Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Gardening show, always a popular one, so call early, please, 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Bob and Fred and your gardening calls coming up right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining me today on the line to answer your gardening questions, we have Bob Graves, co-owner of Fadigan's Nursery in Latham, New York, and Fred Breglia, who is director of the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York. You got a gardening question? This is a wonderful time to call. And I say wonderful because, you know, by the end of the show, all 10 lines will be loaded, and then people are understandably irritated. So if you want to get your call in, do it now. 800-348-2551 is the number, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. And ditto the advice I just gave. Email early. Otherwise, you know, there's only so much time, right? Well, let's welcome back our panel of experts. Bob Graves, who did a solo performance not too long ago. Welcome back, sir.
Hey, it's good to be back. I didn't expect to be back quite this soon, but this is great.
Well, it is great. And, you know, Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum, Bob was somebody left him high and dry the last time we did a show. and he did really, really well. So I just want you to know you are on notice.
I think there might have been a small mix-up one way or the other, but I'm here now, and hopefully I can make up for it today.
So basically what you're saying is you accept no culpability for this at all.
Very little.
All right. Well, let's start out with a few emails here, and then we'll get rolling here. This one came in quite a while ago from Jim, Big Jim, as a matter of fact. He wants to know, when should I trim a burning bush?
You know, burning bush can, you know, this is a good time to start to do some summer pruning. So depending on how much he wants to take off it, you could selectively do some pruning now about, I'd say, about 25% of the foliage, total volume coming off the plant at any one session. But this is the open door to the what I call the summer pruning season. So, you know, I've already begun to do some selective pruning here or there. And anything that's a spring bloomer, you know, it's not too late to get out there and like lilacs, to still prune them. Because if you wait any longer on those, you're going to start taking off next year's flower buds. But burning bush, not a flower issue, really tough plant. You could definitely start it now, about 25% of the foliage in one session, no more than that.
Bob?
Yeah, the rule of thumb I like is to trim when things are in a period of growth, but not most active growth. So you don't trim most things in the spring. But in the summertime, right, they're still growing. And the reason for this is they still have enough, they have a lot of opportunity to produce energy to repair those wounds. They're going to callus over those wounds.
All right. This one is from Gene in Colony. Gene says, most of my garden is amazing this year. I plant a lot of basil in pots. Some of it's getting yellow while other plants look great. Some of the plants get more sun than others. Could some of it be burning from all the sun we had prior to this week, that is? And that's from Gene in Colony.
Yeah, that kind of depends on where they are before they went where they are now. You know, plants need to adapt to the light level that they're in slowly. So if a plant's grown in a little bit of shade, you can't put it out in the sun immediately because it will burn, because the cell walls have to thicken and get able to withstand that sunlight. So that could be it. It could be a fertility problem. Basil do not like cold. So if they were planted early and they got below 50 degrees for a little while, they never recover from that. There's also a fungal disease that can get on them sometimes, so it could be a bunch of different things.
Fred?
Yeah, I would say, you know, if they've been in the sun the whole time, then, you know, they're having a lot more sun on them now is not going to make much of a factor. They can handle, basil can take a lot of sun. So it would be more like what Bob said, if they were in a shadier area and they moved them straight out into a really sunny area, that would give the shock. But otherwise, I would say it could be a combination of like watering, improper watering, possibly too much top water. A lot of times you don't want to have water all over those leaves. I don't know exactly when they're watering, so that would be, you know, an issue. But we do like to keep the leaves dry on these plants, and, you know, doing watering in the evening and getting the leaves really wet, that's setting yourself up for more fungal problems. So certainly would not advocate, getting the leaves really soaked, especially in the evening. And that may be part of the reason as well. Overall, you know, too much moisture. And, we haven't really had too much moisture until very recently. But too much moisture would also cause a yellowing type of an effect, especially with some of those plants.
This one's from John in East Greenbush. I have many issues in the flower beds this spring. Number one, every year I have wonderful peonies. This year only two or three blooms on about 40 plants. Only about one-third of my irises bloomed. Few blooms on the lilacs. Only about one half of the tall lilacs came back from transplanting last fall. On the rhodies and azalea, the blooms only lasted about a week. I live in Zone 4, East Greenbush. Any thoughts? And that is from John.
Well, you certainly have concern when the flowers blast quickly. That's usually the heat. You know, rhodies, some of these plants can flower for two or three weeks if it's cool, but if we have the 80, 90-degree weather, those flowers are going to go by really quickly. The lilacs that didn't bloom well, if they're transplanted last year, that's pretty normal that they're not going to bloom as well the next year. That's pretty common.
All right.
Yeah, and as long as he's getting enough sun on those lilacs, and we don't know how old, but he said transplant. So, you know, my thinking is they're not overly old or overly spindly, but if they are those old, overgrown lilacs, they often do need rejuvenation pruning and to get that to be a really nice onset of flowers continuously. So, you know, transplanting them is going to set them back in general. And, you know, next year I would assume that he would see more blossoms. Pruning is going to make a big difference. We had mentioned really briefly that, that if you're going to prune things that are spring bloomers like lilacs, the time to prune them is actually right after they bloom. So we're a little late right now, but you prune those lilacs a little bit later than this, and you're going to be taking off all of next year's flower buds. So midsummer pruning works great for a lot of plants, and it's not going to hurt lilacs, but it would take away all your blooms. That'd be the same thing for forsythia and rhododendrons.
All right, this last email for now, and then we will take a quick break, hit the phones, and do some emails later in the program. This is from Brian. Brian writes, "When I grow strawberries, the bugs always seem to get them. What do you think of growing strawberry plants out of a hanging basket to keep them off the ground?" And that's from Brian.
You know, I've seen people do that pretty effectively. It does work. I don't know if that would necessarily mean that you're not going to get bugs, though, because they still fly and they still can crawl up things. There are floating row covers that you could cover those crops with during the peak times when they're really starting to get in there, the insects and other critters. It'll even keep birds out. And a floating row cover is just nothing more than sort of a mesh type covering that enables the light and the water to go through, but it's too small for the little critters. And that can help, especially when they're really coming into fruit, because, you know, that's when they're really the most vulnerable. It's also when everything wants them, including you.
Bob.
Yeah, if you see people who are growing strawberries commercially, they have to cover them to protect them from the insects, the birds, but also deer. I know of one farmer whose cover blew off right at peak time, and the deer came in and ate every one in one night.
We had the deer eat all of our beautiful corn a couple years ago, and it still stings in the Graff household. Let's take a quick break. Bob Graves is here. Fred Breglia is here. 800-348-2551 is the number. Oh, yeah, we'll get to the phones in a moment. It's Vox Pop on WAMC Gardening once again, and we have Fred Breglia here, Bob Graves here, both to answer your questions at 800-348-2551, and we kick it off with Maurice in Waterville. Maurice.
Hey, how's it going, Ray?
Good. Nice to have you back.
Yeah, glad to be back. All right, here's my simple question. I have two completely the same planters. They're fake whiskey barrels made out of wood. I have them on either side of my door going into the house. They have the same exact soil in it, and I put herbs in each one of them. And the one on the right, the herbs started to die. So I kind of like scratched the soil, gave them a little bit more food. Then they just died. So I replaced them with strawberry plants coming off the side and a sage plant. Now they're starting to die. And it's just this one pot on the right, which, like I said, is the same as the pot on the left. And so I don't understand that. Is there anything I can do?
Or have you ever used that plant before?
What'd you say, Fred?
Have you ever used these planters in the past, or is this the first year you've used them?
They're brand new. I just bought them this year.
Brand new. The only thing I could say, and you know, assuming that you're watering everything exactly the same and seeds or same plants, same sources, you're telling me the same soil and the same containers. I mean, it makes me think that there's, you know, maybe something was in that other container. I mean, it's if one's doing really, really well and the other one just will not support plant life, it makes me think something was in that that maybe is leaching into the soil. What do you think, Bob?
The other thing I would check is to make sure that they both have adequate drainage. It could be that there's a hole in one and the water's draining out and there's not a hole in the other. If those things
that
stay
would do
wet,
it.
Then they're
now,
not going to grow anything.
There's a hole in each one, and I put like a little rock near it so all the soil wouldn't drip out.
I would double check to make sure that that hole's not clogged, because I've seen that happen. As Fred says, there's something obviously different. Usually there's not toxic materials in there, because if it's a whiskey barrel, you know, it was used for whiskey, which is not a problem. Mm. But
I think it's a faux whiskey barrel.
Okay. But it's wood?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you know, maybe that rock moved and it's blocked the hole.
Yeah, I'd really be looking at drainage.
Yeah, and then sometimes with a little trick for planters is that we often sometimes recommend putting some rocks down in towards the bottom.
Well, he did
just
that.
Just a handful of like number two stone or some coarser rocks. And the reason for that is that, just like Bob said about drainage, sometimes those holes will plug up. And if one's plugged up and the other one's not, that's definitely – that would be, you know, night and day difference. And, you know, in the future, when you fill them up with soil, you know, sometimes use a little bit of rocks, especially around the drainage holes. Some of those containers don't always give you enough drainage holes either.
Oh, so maybe another.
Yeah, that's what I did. There's just one sort of like big drainage hole at the bottom of each. And I put some little stones around it. Like the first couple of bits of soil I put it in by hand. I didn't just dump it in there because I didn't want to shift anything.
Okay, so that sounds like you did a pretty good job with that.
Go ahead.
Easy way to tell is just, you know, on the back side of it, drill a little hole inside and see if water comes out of it at the bottom.
Yeah.
Oh, that's an idea.
And the other really quick question I have, I mulch everything with rocks around my plants, around my rose bushes, everything except for my vegetable plants. And I started doing that because I thought it would help heat up the soil.
No.
Is that a good or a bad idea?
No. I've seen terrible things happen when stone is used around plants. The problem is in the wintertime, what it does is it gets much colder and the temperature changes more frequently. There's no insulation value. There's zero R to stone. You want to mulch over it, at least around the plants particularly, so you don't have the cold infiltration to that extent in the wintertime. Mm. And
use wood chips or mulch?
Some kind of bark mulch or wood chips, right around the plant at least, over the root system,
All right, Maurice, thanks a lot for the call. Go ahead, Fred, finish it up.
I was just going to say that the other benefit of mulch, you know, a lot of people feel like, you know, mulch is to help conserve temperature, you know, regulate temperature and control water loss. But, you know, the other major benefit is that if you're using a good mulch, you're actually going to be improving the soil structure as well. So those particles get in there and you actually can introduce and create a better structure, which is going to be better for plant health. So generally using a good bark mulch, hands down, that's the way to go around plants.
You know, speaking of that and putting mulch down, in our garden, not the vegetable garden, but the flower garden, my wife said, hey, I need some topsoil. So I went and bought the, you know, the only thing I'm good for is getting bags of things and giving them to her. I'm not, you know. But I got this stuff out of Vermont, and it's this great topsoil, and I forget the name, but I think it's half topsoil and half manure. And she said that after she has put that down, the weeds are almost non-existent. She doesn't have to weed anymore. Is that
well, you know, it's just because she's using it like a mulch, and that actually is fine too. You can use a good compost. In fact, our vegetable gardens, we are using pretty much a really good grade compost as our mulch. And you put anything when we talk about plant health, you really don't want to go over 3 inches of mulch,
yeah.
Because over that you're going to start to affect the gas exchange process, the air exchange process between the roots and the above ground air, and that happens all the time. Mm. So over 3 inches is not really good for mulching around your trees and your shrubs. But if you're talking about weed suppression in a garden, if you're not right next to your tomatoes, you know, you're a couple of feet away, you could easily go 4 or 5 inches on that.
Interesting.
And that's going to be, you know, pretty much anything underneath that, with the exception of some weed seeds that may have come in on that compost, you're going to have virtually no, it's going to suffocate everything underneath that. So your wife sounds like she's right on here.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, she's got it going this year. Our number is 800-348-2551. Fred Breglia and Bob Graves here to answer your gardening questions. Brian in Brunswick is on. Brian.
Hi there.
Hi.
I've got a question about Japanese knotweed.
Oy. Yikes. Okay,
go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, we're on.
Yeah, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Sure. Go ahead. Oh, boy. Hello? Brian. All right. Brian's been waiting about 20 minutes. Tell you what, if Brian calls back, are you there? Yes, hello, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, Japanese knotweed. Go ahead with. Go ahead with your question.
It's taking over.
Ah.
It's border between my property and the neighbors.
Yeah.
And I've been trying to keep it down, but it just keeps coming back.
Yeah.
I've been pulling it up by the roots.
No, don't do that.
It
no.
just doesn't.
Don't do
no.
that. No, the guys will tell you. No, this is a common problem on this program. Bob, why don't you go first?
Well, we get this one all the time. And I think for what Fred's going to say is the best thing is to keep cutting this. Cut it early in the spring and then keep cutting it. You have to starve that root system. So you want to cut it, take away its ability to produce energy to put back into the roots, and then as it comes back, cut it again. So you basically starve that root system. Cornell has some recommendations, too, if you wanted to use herbicides on them. It has to be done at a very specific time. Right, Fred?
Yeah, that's exactly what I would say. You know, if you can mow it, you're going to win. It's that simple. If you can just get in there and mow it, there's no way knotweed will survive under constant mowing.
But it takes years sometimes.
If you can't mow it, then, you know, you end up in these spaces where, you know, that's where it's going to take more of a hold. So this is what I would do. I would, you know, mow what you can mow and mow it regularly. Don't let it get big so those leaves can keep photosynthesizing. It's just like what Bob said. You want to starve that plant, and mowing down knotweed is the easiest way to do that. And then if it's in an area where you really can't bring the mower in, then that's the area that you're going to have to do a little bit more, maybe hand cutting, and same kind of principle. And if it is in an area where you could smother it with like a heavy-duty weed fabric, you know, I don't like weed fabrics in general, but they are great for smothering areas because it lets the water and the air in, but it definitely will short-term kill those plants underneath. So you do all three of those, I think you're going to be, a win-win. The weed fabric is always just to smother it, and when it dies, we're talking about a month later, 2 months later, get the weed fabric out. You don't want the weeds growing into that stuff. That creates a whole other arsenal of problems in the future if you use weed fabrics.
Well, Brian, thank you very much for the call. And now to Chuck in Del Mar. Chuck, you're on.
Hi, yeah, this is Chuck. I wanted to know, I've gotten in my yard something, I looked it up on the internet, and it's called Japanese stilt grass, and it's just sort of trying to take over the whole yard. And I'm wondering, is there anything in terms of something non-chemical I can do to do it, or do I have to use chemicals to kill it, or what would you recommend?
Grasses in a lawn are tough because your herbicides don't discriminate between one type of grass and another. It may mm-hmm. be that what you want to do is do some consistent overseeding to try to crowd it out. you know, use a perennial rye, something that grows pretty quick, and reseed it several times over the course of a year to try to get rid of it. Mm-hmm. The other thing you can do is manually remove it, or you can use a non-selective contact killer like a vinegar to actually kill it in those spots and have to reseed it, but it'll kill everything. If it's all over the lawn, it gets to be, it's really problematic because, again, things that kill grass don't know what kind of grass you're trying to kill.
I know, that's a real, it's a real issue. Because, and what about, I mean, is there any way, I've been trying to figure out a way to wait, because it's an annual, so if I figure out when it's going to go to seed, can I mow it and down?
Yeah, I mean, you can use it, you can use a pre-emergent like a corn gluten or one of the chemical pre-emergents. And again, you're right, you have to find out when the germination time is. For example, with an annual bluegrass, you have to treat that in the fall. With your crabgrass, you treat it in the spring. So you do want to kind of research that a little bit and see when it does germinate. Yep.
All right, Chuck.
Yeah, and that one can be invasive, too, that one. And also, I was going to say the only addition would be that I don't know if you're looking at a low-light lawn. Are you looking at your lawn being a little bit more lower light?
We lost him, but that's okay.
Oh, if he has lower light conditions, his battle will be harder because a lot of grass doesn't do as well in low lights, but this particular type of grass can tolerate some pretty lower light conditions. So if he has that kind of competition and trying to get a more aggressive variety in there, as Bob had mentioned, to sort of outcompete it, if his light levels are too low, those other grasses, well, they're not going to do as good, and this one's going to do better. So sometimes just incorporating more light into your landscape is a way to do that, and the way to do that often is, you know, depending on what he's got, might be to just limb up some of the lower-lying trees that are in the area and let more light in, enabling them to maybe get a different species to get a little bit stronger hold. I don't know his light conditions there, but I know that that stilt grass can tolerate low light, and then you got an extra hard battle.
Now, is the Japanese stilt grass particularly ugly to look at? I mean, is it green?
Yeah, it's green. It's not really, I wouldn't say ugly. It's just, it can take over, and
but it's a lawn, right? I mean, what's the problem? I never have.
Well, that's sort of my philosophy. With as long as it's green and you can mow it, I suppose it's okay with me in terms of turf. But I am certainly much more of a plant guy in terms of woody plants and even veggies and perennials. But turf is not really my favorite plant. I hate to say that with Bob here.
All right, I'll let you guys fight it out during the break. Let's go back to the phones in Florence and Rotterdam. Rotterdam and Florence, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
I have an azalea bush, and this spring it was all ready to bloom, all buds and everything, and then the snow came and sat on top of it, killed everything. Now the tops are all dead. I want to know, can I really cut that? I have two of them, and they're in the front of my house, and it's part of my planting, and we've been keeping it sort of square, and I suppose they're really not supposed to be that, but can I cut it right down? I can see part of them. There's stuff that's still coming out, but the tops are all dead. Can I really cut that back?
Yeah. So you got a bunch of dead branches kind of sticking up above some low growing foliage that's down low, correct?
Yeah. Well, I think the bottom is starting to grow, but and then every once in a while you get a branch with a couple of leaves on it.
Yeah.
So
there's a couple of options.
And I don't know. Yeah.
So a couple of options for that is that whatever's dead is certainly not coming back. So, you could scrape the bark and make sure that there's green there just under the bark when you scrape it. And if it's green, I'd leave it. But if it's not, and my guess is if there's no leaves on it now, you're probably not going to see too much green. Anything that's dead can certainly be taken back right to the point of origin. So that might be enough right there alone. But if you wanted to really rejuvenate this plant, and as you had mentioned in the beginning of your question, cutting it right back, like to almost ground level or a few inches above, azaleas and rhododendrons are one of the plants that will tolerate what we call rejuvenation pruning. But the timing on that is key, and this is not the time. The time, if you were going to do a complete rejuvenation, would be in the springtime when the buds begin to swell, but they haven't really opened yet.
Okay.
You would actually cut that pretty much about 6 inches to the ground, and then you would let all that new growth kind of grow. You would lose flowers for that season, but then the following year you'd be back in business. But I think I would say start with removing the dead wood first, see what's left, maybe a little selective cutting, and I think you'd be in good shape.
All right, Florence, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. Our number is 800-348-2551. Fred Breglia is here. Bob Graves is here. Well, they're not here. They're on the line, but it seems like they're here. Let's go to Catherine in Kingston. Catherine, you're also here.
Hi there. I have a family of woodchucks living on the property. It's two adults and four little fat guinea pig-like children scambling around, and I have a pollinator garden I've just starting this summer. And will deer spray keep them away? I can't really fence the whole area. I don't know what to do with these guys. I don't want to trap them and kill them. But and I do understand from my research that the baby ones move on and get their own territory once they've come of age. So,
Woodchucks are really tough. The thing with repellents, I would start, you basically don't have any options. Either you're going to trap them or kill them or try to repel them. And the taste repellents work better. That is something you spray on the plant. And that can be a rotten egg garlic concoction. That can be a pepper concoction. That can be a dried blood concoction. There's a bunch of different repellents. And what you do is you start with one and try and see if that works. But if it doesn't work, okay, try a different formulation of repellent. And sooner or later, you're going to find something that they don't like the taste of.
Yeah,
well, commercial deer repellent because I've got hostas and other things that they like. Can I just use that, or
try that first, because I've had people come in and tell me that one repellent worked really well, and another person tell me that that one didn't work, but another one did. So sometimes you have to try different things, and as I say, many of the different repellents have the same formulation, so you need to try a different formulation if that doesn't work, but try that first.
Yeah, and these are things you can make at home too. These repellents, they work really. I mean, you could literally, you know, leave some eggs out, get them really rotted. That works really, really well. Garlic in there, in that concoction works really good. I also add cayenne pepper in there as well. Mm. And you know, at this point, you're going to use a blender of sorts, and you know, probably not going to borrow the wife's blender for this one. But you use a sort of a dedicated blender for these types of concoctions, and it works really, really, really well. The only thing is, when it rains, you have to reapply them. So reapplying them kind of regularly. I would also advocate potentially a fence. They do make
In this area that won't work. I have a fence around another garden, but this one it wouldn't work. And another question. Thank you for that so much. Another quick question. My nasturtiums are turning yellow, and I don't know if it's getting too much of the rain or I'm not. I don't know what it's from. Do you know?
I don't think it's too much of the rain. It might have been too little before this time. In a desert conditions for a month and a half.
I know.
We had no rain in May, basically, to speak of. So most of the problems we're seeing in that regard were as a consequence of having gotten dry during that period. And that will persist for weeks afterwards. You'll tend to get yellow, even if you start to water them afterwards. So that's my guess on that.
Okay.
Yeah, might need a little fertilization, too, if you haven't fertilized at all. With being so dry, even if there's some material nutrients in the soil, it's harder for those plants to take it up. So if you haven't given a little supplemental fertilizer, you may want to do that.
All right, Catherine, we have to take a break here, but thank you for the call. Fred Breglia is here, Bob Graves is here, and it's The Gardening Show. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC, Ray Graff here. It's The Gardening Show. You know, I just wonder how many hours it would take to do this show and finally get through all the calls. We could probably do a 7-hour gardening show. We have so many emails and so many callers. We will do our best to get to as many as we can. The number here is 800-348-2551. And the email address, well, I won't even give you the email address now. We have so many, I won't get to all of them. Fred Breglia is here. Bob Graves is here. And let's take care of a few emails that have come in over the last half hour or 40 minutes or so. This one's from Aaron in Greenfield. Massachusetts. What is this so-called invasive orchid I've seen and heard about? Should we be pulling it up when we see it? Invasive orchid.
Yeah, I'm not sure what he's referring to there.
No.
But, you know, anything that's invasive, you know, basically an invasive plant is something that isn't where you want it. It's kind of the same definition as a weed sometimes. And the only way to get rid of that, something like that, without a selective killer is to pull it out.
Okay.
Yeah, it might be like a broadleafed hellebore, Bob, that he may be talking about, which is more of it's an orchid family plant. It doesn't really look as, to me, it doesn't look quite like an orchid, but I guess it's in that family and it has that kind of flower. And they are sometimes in lawns, and they're not native, and they can, you know, sort of spread out and be a pain in the grass.
That was funny. This one's from ZL, and ZL says, cleaned out an area overgrown with shrubbery and bittersweet. Can I create a small wildflower area by laying down remay and covering with good soil? Area is partly shaded by big trees, and that's from ZL.
Boy, most of your wildflower mixes would rather be in a fair amount of sun. And what I tell people with wildflower mixes is the predominant seed in a wildflower mix is a grass because it needs something to hold the soil. And wildflower mixes, you need to put those down in a very well-prepared area. So, yes, if they wanted to, I don't know that I'd use the fabric, but if they wanted to put down some fresh soil, that would be very nice. Because you want it prepared just as if you were going to seed a lawn. Bare ground, no weeds, nice and clean, but I'm worried about the amount of shade.
Yeah, and skip the fabric, Bob said.
Okay.
Yep.
This one's from Peter in Cooperstown. My lilac bush is about 20 feet high. All of the leaves are curled and brown like it has a disease. This seems to happen each year, usually in the fall. It seems a little early for this to happen. Is the lack of rain causing this? What should I do? That's from Peter.
You know, most likely it could be like a bacterial kind of leaf scorch, and that's probably what it is. I have that on my lilacs sometimes. Some years you see it more towards the fall.
Yeah.
I am seeing it a little bit more this time of year. I've seen a few on the lilacs actually this past week. Most of the time, you know, it doesn't actually hurt the plant if that's what's going on, especially if you've seen it before.
Yeah.
And, you know, clean the leaves up when they fall if they actually drop off. Most of the time they'll hang on. And it doesn't actually cause anything except for a little bit of an unsightliness. But if he is starting to lose the plants from the top down, there could be other issues involved. But my guess is that it's just a bacterial sort of leaf scorch.
If those older branches are dying, you want to be looking for lilac borer. You need to be looking
for
holes in the trunk because you may want to take some of those old branches out and rejuvenate it, as Fred said before, on lilacs.
All right, this one's from Carol. I have been told that my misshapen raspberries are a result of poor pollination. How do I hand pollinate? Same as tomatoes? That's from Carol.
Well, I shouldn't have to, but, you know, you take a little paintbrush, a little soft brush, and you go from flower to flower to flower. That's the way, you know, in some countries they have killed all their insects, and that's the only way they get pollination is by going through with a brush.
Yep. Right. Typically not needed on raspberries like that, but, you know, for some reason, if they're not getting enough, then, you know, that would certainly work.
All right, this one's from Rosalind in Clifton Park. We'll do two more emails, and then we'll get back to the phones. This is from Rosalind. She says, when can a huge clump of irises be safely divided for half to be transplanted elsewhere? And that's from Rosalind in Clifton Park.
Yeah, that's something you want to do in August, usually. You know, once they've started to deteriorate, most perennials, you know, once a plant has started to deteriorate, you never move things when they're period of most active growth. So it's usually August or September for something like that.
All right, this one is specifically, I think Fred will be all over this like a cheap suit. this one is from Mike in Rexford. Mike writes, I think that I have identified several elm trees along the bank of the Mohawk River near Clifton Park. My wife says I'm crazy. Dutch elm disease killed them all years ago. So am I right? Are there elm trees in this area? And that is from Mike in Rexford.
Yeah, the answer to that is there's lots of elm trees everywhere. And, you know, Dutch elm disease did a real number on them. And, you know, every community, including, you know, over here in Cobleskill, I know they have an Elm Street. So, you know, there's almost every, and you know, almost on every single Elm Street, you don't find any elms. It's because they all died of Dutch elm disease. So, you know, they're kind of partially, you know, sounds like they're both kind of a little bit right there. But the reality is, in the wild, the American elm is everywhere. Finding the really large American elms now That's another thing. And, you know, we are always looking, you know, looking for the big trees.
Right.
We're always looking for, you know, giant American elms, but you don't see too many big American elms anymore. Every once in a while, you'll see a big one and you're like, wow. And they're not even historically close to as big as they used to be. They can used to be at a, you know, have trees that would shade an entire acre from their one tree from the canopy.
Yeah.
So massive, massive trees. But we have, you know, thousands of elm trees here at Landis Arboretum. They are literally everywhere. They grow up, they get, you know, kind of big kind of quickly, but they almost always die to Dutch elm disease way before they ever become a mature large tree. But you'll see elms everywhere. So he was right.
All right, back to the phones at Barbara in Saratoga. Barbara, you're up.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm new to gardening, relatively new to gardening, and I put in some seeds, some flowers. And I don't know what's sprouting. I don't know how to tell if it's a weed or a flower. I'm looking for an online resource that I can just go to and try to figure out what I'm looking at in the garden.
that's a tough one. I mean, we have a weed identification book here, and I think it's 300 or 400 pages long. That's really hard.
It's really the flowers that I'm growing. I want to know what they look like when they've shot up. They're not yet.
Sure.
So
I mean,
it looks like the pattern.
Understood. Yeah. Well, you can certainly look up the variety if you know what the varieties are. Sure, you can find pictures of them, but you're going to need to know what you planted.
Yeah, and have a little patience because, you know, there's probably no harder time to ID plants than when they're really tiny. The first set of leaves that pop up are cotyledons, and they're not even considered true leaves. They don't look anything like the real leaf. And then a lot of plants actually will put out a first set of leaves, and those are just kind of maybe not completely exactly like the mature leaf either. So sometimes when you're new, I tell people to just be a little bit more patient than not, because it's okay if there's some weeds growing around. You know, take it from me. We've got weeds in our vegetable garden all over the place too. It's a never ending job. That's why I'm still in business over here. But you know, in any case, don't be afraid to leave some weeds. You don't need to get them out instantly. You can have the weeds growing next to your plants for a while, and then once those, I don't know how tall your plants are, but once they start to get up a little bit larger, they get a lot easier to start to recognize even well before they come into bloom. You also, if you are a Facebook person, there are quite a few groups out there that are like plant identification groups and garden identification groups and, you know, gardening 101, beginner gardeners, you name it, there's a group for probably someone out there. So you look into some of those groups and, you know, they all have, a lot of them have specific rules for posting, but, you know, they're set up for, you know, a lot of them are set up for those kinds of identifications. And there's a lot of people that just, you know, they're looking for the next plant. You know, what's this? They want to be the first to answer. So that might be, you know, another resource to learn some more stuff too.
Well, Barbara, thank you very much for the call. Now over to Keith in Pine Bush. Keith, you're on.
Hi, guys. I enjoy the program.
Thank you.
I have a question about my tomatoes and cucumbers. For the past two or three seasons, they look fantastic up until about this time of year, and they start to develop a yellowing of the leaves and spots on the leaves, and the plant just seems to shut down, and it's really decreased the yield of the plants. I'm getting maybe half of the yield of that I would usually expect. I don't know if it's a fungus, a mildew, or a blight type thing. So what I try to do this year is move the plants. Like, I moved the plants in the garden, so the tomatoes weren't growing where the tomatoes were growing last year, and the cucumbers were not growing where they were growing last year. And I tried to clean the garden up really good in March. And I used a copper fungicide, but I'm still seeing signs of the disease occurring again.
First question is, are you watering overhead? Are they getting wet?
I'm trying to water from the roots.
Yeah.
No, I don't.
Yeah, you got it.
I water with a hose, and I try to water where the roots are. But,
yeah, okay. try not to get the leaves wet, which we talked about before. And, you know, fungicides aren't any good once the problem shows up. They need to be done prophylactically before you see a problem.
So copper is one, but fungicides are like antibiotics with people too. Some fungicides work on some things and not on others. So there are some organic types. Also, sulfur is an old fungicide, but you need to apply them fairly frequently and before you see the problem. But it sounds like, you know, the things you describe, blight, fungus, mildew, they're all the same thing. They're all fungi. And it sounds like that's what your problem is.
Yeah, you know, sometimes also I don't know what kind of seeds you're using or if you're using the same plants, you know, same seeds over and over. But there are some varieties that are way more resistant to it, too. And there are some varieties that are way more, you know, they attract, you know, fungus issues way more so. And that's what almost all plants, crab apples are resistant varieties, birches, there's resistant varieties. When there's tomatoes that, you know, you can get sometimes heirloom or some of those organic-y heirloom older varieties. And they've been in the area for a long time and they seem to do sometimes a little bit better. There's also some new varieties that do really, really, really good and have shown incredible amounts of resistance. So a little bit of research if you're having that reoccurring problem and as to which variety for you is the right ones, the easiest ones or the ones with the least amount of problems but the maximum amount of flavor. That's kind of what you're going for. I mean, that's, you know, it's the classic plant the right seed in the right spot. It's going to do good.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the wrong seed, even if it's the right plant and it's just, you know, not for our area, your area, you might have some, you know, missed results there. Also, if you're getting, I don't know if you're getting full sun in that garden or not, that would play a role. If you have any kind of wind movement through that garden, or is it really sheltered garden? You know, those are also factors. Fertilization with the cucumber leaves could be, you know, sort of a fertilization issue. It whatever attacks the tomato won't attack the cucumber. That's guaranteed. Mm. So, you know, those are all factors.
All right, Keith, thank you very much for the call. Over to Madeline in Rhinebeck. Madeline.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First, just to the caller who was talking as a new gardener, identifying weeds and such, it might also be helpful. There's a great app called The Naturalist, and if you take photos, it'll identify what the plant is. It may not work when they're really small, but it might be helpful for her. So that was the first thing. But
okay.
My question is, I would like to plant a mountain laurel shrub, and I have a couple of questions. One is, when I look at the light range, when I look that up, it says deep shade to full sun. So is that accurate?
Well, you know,
in my mind, no.
Not exactly. It does tolerate a range of filtered light, partial sun. But I don't even know if you'd want to go deep shade.
Not deep shade, not full sun, you know.
Yeah.
The example I use is if you drive the Massachusetts Turnpike from here to Boston, from Capital District to Boston, they grow on one side of the road and not on the other because they like the morning sun and not the afternoon sun.
Oh, very interesting.
So typically,
well,
if they get the morning sun, they're fine.
Oh, works for you, Madeline?
That works, yeah. My other question about the mountain laurel is, it said that the leaves were poisonous, and I think it said the flower nectar was poisonous. Is this a problem for bees and butterflies and hummingbirds?
Definitely not an insect problem.
No?
No.
Okay.
The insects are, you know, love them. You'll see tons of bees and stuff, and it's never going to hurt the bees.
All right, so don't eat the nectar yourself is the bottom line here, Madeline.
Yeah, I would leave it for the insects, and you're good. Also, one other tip is if you're getting a windy spot, mountain laurel's, you know, probably going to end up getting desiccated or dried out leaves in the wintertime, especially the wintertime if it's a windy spot. So keep that in mind.
No.
It doesn't like a lot of wind.
All right, yep. Well, thanks a lot for the call. Very quickly now over to Vodney in Mountaindale, you're on.
Hi there. I have a quick question for you. I've had a long time a smoke bush. It's healthy. It has leaves. It's growing. It will not smoke. What can I do?
Is that legal in New York?
It's a pinky, and when it does it, and I cannot figure it out. Is there something I can do as a soil test? What's the pH that it should be?
Is it in a lot of sun?
No, it's in the same kind of sun that the hostas like, and it's not in a full sun.
Well, they really like to be in a lot of sun. That would
afternoon.
Yeah, it may simply be that it's not enough sun. You know, sometimes plants will grow very well, but they won't flower as well if they're not getting a whole lot of sun. So that would be my first thought. The other thing you could do to try to shock it to bloom a little bit is to root prune it a little bit. Sometimes that'll work, but I'm worried about the amount of sun.
Yeah, I actually would back that up as well,
Bob.
You
mean go in and literally pull some root down from it?
No, you would actually go through and you would use a spade, which is like a sort of a flat-bladed shovel, sharpened. You actually are going to go out around a drip line of this plant, and you're literally just going to put the spade in the ground like you were going to dig something up, only you're not going to attempt to dig it up at all. You're not even going to move the spade. It's just going to go straight
exactly
in
what you're talking about.
And pull it straight out and go trace that, you know, to the depth of the spade and do it around the entire plant. And what that's done is it's trimmed a bunch of roots, and that's a shocker. And the reason why Bob mentioned that is because sometimes plants, when they go into a stress, which that would be, it forces them to actually bloom because it's a natural its response to stress is, hey, I need to reproduce. I need to reproduce. So it puts out flowers, which...
It's very possible this thing made a ton of roots before it really did much of anything else. Thank you so much, guys. I will try either. It gets a fair amount of sun. About 7 hours. That isn't enough, you think?
You could also try giving it a balanced fertilizer, something a little higher with phosphorus and potassium, actually. Probably a little bit like a 5-10-10 complete fertilizer.
Yes.
Blossoms are going to need... phosphorus and potassium in the highest quantity to produce. I don't think it's that. It sounds like maybe just not enough sun. It likes, 8 hours of sun. Hmm. So, it could live, it could tolerate and grow, just like a lilac. You put lilac in the shade, it's going to grow and live there for a long, long time, but may never really flower too well for you.
All right, Vonnie, thanks a lot for the call. By the way, what is a smoke bush? I've never heard of such a thing.
It's a type of species. The genus is Cotinus. The common one is Cotinus cagigrea. There's an American smoke tree. It's related to that. It's Cotinus, but it's obovatus. And a tree will actually get to be a quite large. In fact, it could be a full size, when I say full 30 foot, 40 foot tall. But the smoke bush is more of an ornamental. A lot of times you see them with reddish colored foliage and really puffy flowers.
Yeah.
They look like plumes of smoke, hence the name smoke bush.
Right.
And those are legal here in New York.
All right, fair enough. That's it for the show. Hey, guys, thanks a lot for being here. Support comes from Mother Earth Storehouse, open 7 days, working to help keep our communities safe and supplied with EDC goods and services, serving the Hudson Valley with organic and all natural foods since 1978. Mother Earth Storehouse. And Adirondack Experience, the museum on Blue Mountain Lake, announcing their new website with online activities and resources for all ages, adkx.org, for viewing. Well, once again, thanks to Bob Graves and Fred Breglia for being here. Thank you all for listening and for calling. Apologies to the many left on the line and the many emails we didn't get to today. These guys will be back sooner rather than later. And thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer, who presumably will be back tomorrow as well. Jordan Yoxall took the calls. Our producer is Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, astronomy with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. That's tomorrow at 2. Right now, stand by for 51%.